You're listening to a Stranger podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, this is Jen Graves. You're listening to Invisible, a Stranger's Conversation with People in Art. I'm here at The Stranger with Alice Wheeler, and we are sitting with a copy of Gary Winogrand's Women Are Beautiful. Women Are Beautiful is the name of Alice's show at Greg Kucera Gallery right now. And also, there's going to be another opening for that show first Thursday in August. But let's talk about this book. When did you first see this? This is Glenn Rudolph's copy.
Yes, I don't own a copy of Women Are Beautiful myself. Now it's actually worth about $1,000 on
eBay. Even though
eBay.
This one was bought for $350.
Oh, yeah.
It says, like, in the front, there's
and
a little...
Originally, the first place I saw it was before I went to Evergreen in the early 80s. I had a friend who liked to garage sale a lot, and he bought a copy for 50 cents. And he brought it back to his house, and we were looking at it, and he thought it was the stupidest thing he'd ever seen in his life. And he was making fun of all the pictures, and I was completely fascinated by it. And I couldn't get it out of my head. And then I think the next year when I went down to Evergreen, you know, the teachers were really big on all those 60s photographers, and they had a copy of it in the Rare Books collection at Evergreen.
Oh, my God.
So that's
one year later?
Maybe 1 or 2 years later. Yeah.
That's funny.
But I really hadn't heard of Gary Winogrand since before that.
What did you like about these?
Well, I love their immediacy, and I love the composition. My work is really influenced by a lot of the 60s photographers. Not only Winogrand, but Arbus and Ouija, who's, I guess, pre-60s. And Larry Fink and a lot of those people. And that's kind of who I studied in school. And it's about making art out of your own environment. Mm-hmm. It's not about traveling to foreign countries and doing it. I mean, you can, but first and foremost, you make art about what's around you and what your life is. Mm-hmm. And part of why I like it is the style of shooting is really interactive with people. And so as I've gotten older, living in the Northwest, you know, we don't have a lot of human contact here sometimes. So photography has always been a great excuse for me to go out and meet strangers and talk to people and just go out and interact and go to things.
What are your rules when you shoot?
You know, I kind of get into a creative zone, and so I'm not really thinking in words.
Mm-hmm. But, like, how do you have rules about, like, I won't shoot this person without asking them, or I will, or I, how do you, like...
No, it just depends on the situation whether I ask or not, because a lot of times people have these awesome expressions on their faces that they lose as soon as you ask them, and you can never get it back, so it's better to snap the shot first, but if you think you're going to get punched, sometimes it's not the better. So if they look like they might punch you, then it's probably better to ask first. In which case, they're always going to say no, so it doesn't matter.
Really?
Oh, yeah. In Seattle, people say no all the time because everybody thinks they're somebody here. And one of the funniest experiences I've had is when I was shooting restaurant things for the Weekly about 10 years ago, and I'd be photographing the chef or something over in one corner of the restaurant, and somebody from the opposite end of the restaurant, 40 feet away, would come over and yell at me, like, "You can't take my photo!" Like, who knew who they were? They were probably married to one of the sports guys. I don't know. I mean, they looked like they thought they were somebody. I have no idea. They weren't even in the photo. It was dark. Like, duh. They were, like, so egotistical that they just
think
that. Yeah, that kind of thing happens all the time. In some ways, that's why it's so awesome to go shoot in Montana or where I'm from in Nebraska. Mm-hmm. Because nobody ever asks you what you're going to do with the photo. Mm-hmm. Here, they all want to be rock star models, so they all want to get copies. Right now, the latest thing is they're really paranoid it's going to go online right away and they're going to get outed for whatever little naughty tricks they were up to last night.
Right.
And I'm like, if they go online, I'm not an immediate blog thing. It's going to be like a couple of years. Like, don't worry. It's not going to, like, out you for what you were doing last weekend, cheating on your boyfriend or whatever, you know.
When you're looking, I mean, one of the things that I'm really interested in terms of this book, Women Are Beautiful, is that you were just pointing out that some of these images and some of the images that you've shot in this show have characters that seem to be, like, from Ouija or from this series. And, like, you must have this sort of archive in your brain of things you're recognizing maybe without even realizing it.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what's going on. And then I'm kind of also, like, so completely fascinated by these old people. Like, I mean, in some ways, I was sort of obsessed with them when I was a student, you know, 25 years ago or whatever. And I think that they have, like, planted themselves in my brain because I've spent so much time looking at the images. But what's interesting is I don't notice them when I'm out shooting. They only turn up later when I'm editing the contact sheets. And oftentimes you don't see them until you blow them up bigger. You know, you can't really tell if they're going to be like that. And so it's almost like this channeling process. Like, it's not something I'm necessarily aware of. But what I will say is I've really, really trained myself to look for personalities and characters and people that are projecting who they are on their surface. Because a lot of people in Seattle are really passive, you know. And so I'm most interested in the people that, like Jack Kerouac said, burn, burn, burn like a Roman candle. You know, the eccentric ones, the mad ones, the ones that are mad for life, mad for, you know, I can't remember the whole quote, but it's like, goes along like that. It's from On the Road. And interestingly enough, I read On the Road when I was 15 and I got my first job at a vintage store and I found it and I was working there and I just read it offhand because I was bored. Like, no one would come in for hours, so you'd sit there and read. And it was about traveling, and it was about traveling to the West Coast. And, you know, I've always had this urge to travel, and I've always loved the West. And for some reason, like, Kerouac really tantalized me, and I think that's part of why I ended up in Seattle. You know, because my other favorite book by him is Desolation Angels, and the very first part of it, he's on fire watch up at Desolation Peak up in Skagit Valley, you know, where all the artists live. And then he hitchhikes down to Seattle. And he ends up at a hotel that was on the site of the federal building. Now, the archway outside the federal building is from that hotel that he stays at in that book. And I don't know how I knew this, but somebody told me right away, because the federal building had just been built when I first moved here. Like, I moved here in 1981.
Where's the federal building?
On 2nd Avenue, you know. And then there's, like, a big archway out in front of it, and that's what was left from the hotel. And there were still a lot of those really cheap hotels downtown when I moved here. Like, the first place I stayed was $8 a night on 1st Avenue.
When was that?
In 1981, 28 years ago, just, I think, this month, so.
Wow.
You know, it was a very different place, very blue collar, very Wild West, you know. And so Seattle, in my mind, still has a lot of those qualities, and I'm really attracted to that quality of the West. And I think that a lot of this project and my other projects in general try to show that spirit of it. And in this case, I'm trying to interpret it with women. Because, like, I've been thinking about a lot about women's place in society, and especially now that Barack Obama is in, I feel like things have changed again. Like, I've actually been working on this show for about 3 years, and some of the images date back pretty far. But, you know, because I always shoot on many different subjects at once, and then I go back and edit later. So it's like nobody's ever seen these images, so I still consider them new, even if they were shot, like, 10 years ago, because nobody's ever seen them before. So, and I think sometimes it's interesting to wait and leave some time in history before you look at an image, because it makes it more interesting. Like, frankly, I think this WTO image, anti-fur protester WTO, to me, is more interesting now than it was then within the context of WTO, because there were so many shots of WTO, and maybe the action shots were more appropriate then. But, like, within this context about women are beautiful, it's really interesting because it's about women's freedom to do what they want in public. You know, that's what this whole show is about, is sort of about women's space in public and how much space we're allowed to own before men come out and harass us back into our little, you know, closets or whatever. And I feel like that's what Winogrand was talking about, is he was showing the very first vestiges of women breaking out from the classic social role into being individuals, into showing their sexuality in public, into being, having not to walk down the street escorted by a man, you know, into having their own jobs and having their own lives. So he started this, and people didn't understand it at the time. But now, in Seattle, especially in the last 10 years, things have changed for women. Like, there's a lot more public sexuality. And, you know, compared to when I first moved here, like I said, it was the Wild West. So you weren't necessarily safe in a lot of places. Like, you did have to be very careful where you went and stuff because it was man's land. I mean, Seattle was definitely man's land. And, you know, there's still a lot of places in Seattle that are man's land. You know, and I call that, like, down by the Duwamish. Like, when I like to go down there and photograph, there's never any women. I've gone down there a dozen times to photograph, and there's never any women. And you have to be careful that somebody's not going to jump you out of the bushes or whatever. You just have to be aware. You know, and I'm not saying I don't go there and do that. I like to do that. But, you know, most women don't choose to do those kind of photos by themselves, you know. I mean, most women photographers end up doing completely different things, you know, based on their safety, you know what I mean? And so this is kind of an interesting project because it's showing women in different environments, like around Seattle and other places, and it's showing just, like, where the boundaries of the freedom are now, I think.
Where do you think they are? Where do you see them?
Well, I think in sometimes they're really, really wide. Like, in this photograph called Women with Rollerblades on 4th Avenue, Pride Parade, Seattle, Washington. And that's actually taken right in front of the library last Pride. And she's completely naked, and she has flames painted on her. And she's completely standing in a very, you know, just confident position. Like, she's not ashamed of her body on any level. And to me, that's amazing. Because, like, until maybe 15 years ago, you did not see public nudity in Seattle at all. It was very, very puritanical. And then things really did change, like, when, you know, after the grunge revolution and the riot girl revolution and stuff. And, like, now you see topless women at protests. Like, I remember, like, maybe 10 years ago was about the first time, you know, WTO was about the first time I saw them. And now I've seen them a few times, and there's definitely more topless women in public. You know, there's always the dykes on bikes, you know, but they always rode by so fast you could never get a shot of them. You know, it's like they don't like stop and pose for you like one on one. You know, they're still a little bit embarrassed about it, you know. So now I think that there's some women that are taking it all the way to the extreme, but at the same time, I still think there's a lot of places where it's not necessarily safe for women to be themselves, you know. So I think that now women have carved out different areas where they feel safe. And what's interesting is a lot of protests or parades are where women feel safe to express themselves. So I'm really lucky about being able to go out and get
those images.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that one of the things that strikes me, do you feel like that these photographs in some ways are a record of these women looking at you?
Definitely. Because I think that they're... My reaction to these women is completely different from Winograd's reaction to his women. Because he's an older guy looking at younger women in a
between marriages.
Way.
And he focuses on breasts. He is
well,
so
he's hot
focused.
For them, right?
And you said you're following Green Eyes. You happen to be following.
Well, I didn't know I was following Green Eyes. What I think I'm following is like a projection of myself, basically, because I'm not gay. So I'm not like, you know, thinking, I mean, I think they're cute because they're, you know, women and men are cute.
Right.
Especially when they're all dolled up and they're dressed up and they're out for an event. You know, who isn't cute when they do that? I mean, I like all people. But, you know, I'm not chasing them to get a date or anything like that. I'm chasing them because I see aspects of myself. You know, and also aspects of things I'm looking for. Like, I've been looking for archetypal images of women, which is why I like this one of Molly as Marie Antoinette so much, because not only is it a great photo, but Marie Antoinette is like the classic bitch, you know. I mean, everyone loves to hate her. And, you know, in our lifetimes, you know, whether we respect them or not, there's so many women that they like to build up and then rip down. Most recently, Sarah Palin, who I don't especially care about, but it is kind of hard to watch them rip her down on TV just because, you know, it could be anybody. You know, it's like this morning I was watching the Sonia Sotomayor hearings before I came in, and they're doing the exact same thing to her. You know, it's like the Republicans are going off about empathy, like somehow empathy is this huge dirty word. And what I think is totally interesting, I went to Evergreen, and that was the whole basis of the education down there, was empathy. Empathy for other people and trying to understand other points of view and thinking and identifying your point of view within the context of the rest of the world. Like, you're not just, you're not the one and only right way. You might have your own right way or your own meaning of life for yourself, and it's important to identify that and decide what it is and decide why you're focusing on something. Because it's like we all have obsessions. But it's, like, better to have a positive obsession, like, with art, like liking to chase people down the street that are dressed up and take their photos because it's sort of innocent, you know, in a certain way. I mean, it's not necessarily harmful as opposed to gambling or, you know, heroin or something like that, you know. So I don't know. A lot of people I know made those choices in their 20s, you know, and a lot of my friends aren't here because of it because they made the wrong choices. Instead of becoming obsessed with art, they become obsessed with some guy who, like, you know, abused them and gave them AIDS and whatever. And, you know, it's like this and that.
Do you feel like the empathy charge that the Republicans are are putting on Sotomayor has to do with gender. Yeah. Like, they're just trying to make
gender, and I think it's thought process, because I noticed they've been taking, like, Obama the same way. Mm-hmm. And what I figured out is there's the narcissistic way of looking at things, like, I'm right, I'm 100% right, you guys are all a bunch of piece of crap, I'm going to make you feel like you're a small, 2-inch-tall piece of crap, so I can feel better about myself, and I'm going to tell you that I'm the big dad, and I'm going to, you know, you've got to go along now, and you've got to be a nice girl to go along now. You know, and then Obama comes in and says, oh, let's be inclusive. Let's look at things from other people's point of view. Let's try to have empathy for others. Let's reach out. Like, he went to Ghana this weekend. I mean, how cool was that? You know, it's like the first African-American president mm-hmm. in Africa. And, like, everyone was so happy. And they have these huge posters of him up everywhere. Like, I wish I could have been with him to take photos. It would have been amazing.
Yeah.
You know, and then, like, you know, it's just, I think that he's running things, like, his administration reminds me of the way Evergreen thinks about things, and it's inclusive, and it's about, you know, identifying your own point of view, but also giving respect to others' point of view,
mm-hmm.
and I think that that's totally different from, like, the narcissistic point of view, which is there's one right way, and everybody better damn well go along, mm-hmm. otherwise you're a sinner, and you're gonna go to hell,
mm-hmm.
you know, so, I mean.
I feel like your photographs are, in this show, are actually representing a lot of different kinds of perspectives, speaking of that.
Oh, interesting.
One of them is, this one is really interesting. These two happen to be, we printed out the sheets of the website for Greg so we could have the images here on the table with us. And these two happen to be on the same page, and I actually wanted to bring them up together. But very, like, insanely friendly-looking juggalo at Hemfest seems to, like, be the most friendly-looking juggalo in the world. And then Mary at the Bohemian Cafe in Omaha, who is apparently, like a person who's serving food there, right?
Yeah.
Like a waitress.
Yeah, she's a waitress, and she's, like, in her 70s, and she's been there forever, and... I grew up in Omaha, and the Bohemian Cafe was my father's favorite place to eat.
Mm.
And so I was back, like, 2 years ago in 2007 because he was sick and dying. And he died that morning.
Oh, my goodness.
And so we went with our family friends over to the Bohemian Cafe for dinner that night because it's sort of in honor of him. And it was like my old family friends that grew up with him. And then their dad was in charge of his estate. So he was sort of helping me and my sister through it. And then my sister was just pitching a fit. She was so upset. Like, she was just yelling at me the whole time because she didn't want to go there. She was mad because my dad died, but she likes to take it out on me. She's kind of a bully. So... it's like, you know, so I wanted to, like, chill out and, like, do my own thing. And I was really excited about Mary because she was so sweet. She was in her late 70s. She's been a waitress there forever. Mm-hmm. It's the same place, the same food, the best. You know, Bohemian food is not that great, but the kolaches are awesome. The whole place is decorated with all these weird wood paintings. She has the same uniform on as forever. But the younger servers, she told me, they don't like to wear the whole uniform. They just had red vests and black pants on. And when I was a little kid, because the Czechs are very big in Nebraska. It was the big ethnic group when I was born in the early 60s. And I had a little Czech doll with her uniform, her same outfit on.
The same one that Mary's wearing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I was very attracted to her. And then she was such a sweet character that I spent a little bit of time with her. And then it was funny because my sister was so mad. She was like, we don't have time for this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, geez, give me 5 minutes, you know. And so then I think the other thing about the juggalos is I love juggalos. I like to photograph them everywhere. Now, I've never been to an Insane Clown Posse concert because I'm a little bit afraid of them. But at Folklife for Hempfest is the perfect place to photograph juggalos. Although sometimes it's still hard to photograph them, you know, depending on how amped up they are. And, what I like about that photo is it just shows you the difference between my work and Winogrand's work is I'm getting a completely different response from the women than I'm photographing. I mean, she feels kindly towards me,
mm-hmm.
almost like a motherly figure.
Because
a lot of these people are, like, they can
younger.
Be my kids. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like them because I always like eccentric kids. I was an eccentric kid, and I support kids' rights to be eccentric when they're young and to be into stuff. And I just think, you know, that's why she has, like, the Mona Lisa smile
on.
And, again, when I printed that, I realized she had green eyes, and I didn't know at all. I wasn't thinking about it when I took the pictures, but I think that the reason I'm so attracted to women with green eyes is because my mother has green eyes. So I think it's like a little thing in the back of my head that I didn't even realize about myself until I made the show, which I love discovering things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know what it means, yeah. But, you know, the other thing I like about this Juggalo woman is that her boyfriend looks so goofy, and she just looks like she's leading him. And so that says something about women's power.
Mm.
You know what I mean? In the same way about Mary at the Bohemian Cafe, I think this says something about her power. She doesn't feel a lot of power.
Yeah. Well, the photograph looks taken from above. She's very short.
Yeah,
because her head looks huge and her feet look tiny.
I know. You know what's funny is I have a photo of myself taken like that when I was younger that somebody else took in L.A. when I was a punk rocker. It's in that book, We're Desperate or something, and it has a big head with a big shadow behind it. Which doesn't bother me as much because then it looks like a Cupid doll.
Yeah. Yeah,
she looks like a Cupid doll.
Yeah.
But it's because she was about, probably 5 feet tall, and I'm about 5'9", so I'm kind of towering over her a little bit.
Yeah.
And if I would have had more time, I probably would have moved around a little bit more. But, you know, it's hard when somebody's yelling at you to get stuff done.
Right.
So.
What do you tell her? Like, what do you tell people to do? Do you tell them to do anything?
No. I let them do whatever they want.
Just say, I'm going to shoot.
Oh, I say, look at me.
Look. Oh, you do.
Yeah, usually, because I like to address the person because I like the women to appear strong. And to me, like, when I started looking at images of women, you know, because I've been thinking about images of women, you know, ever since I started reading fashion magazines in the 70s. And then I've been thinking about, you know, because I've taken a lot of art. My mom was an art teacher at the Joslin in Omaha when I grew up. And, you know, she's a painter. She went, she has her master's degree in painting and took extra classes at the Art Students League in New York and stuff. So she, you know, has done a lot of painting, and we grew up looking at art and stuff. And they always talked about the male gaze.
Yeah.
You know, and so I was wondering about this male gaze on women. Like, we studied it in the 80s in college. Like, you know, that this is art. Pictures of women in art are about how men look at women. And so I started thinking, well, how come there's no pictures that women make of how we feel about ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how is this such a radical idea? But apparently it is. Like, I didn't really think it was. You know, like, to me this seems sort of normal.
Yeah.
But then, like, apparently it's sort of a radical idea because I have gotten some pretty negative feedback from a couple of guys about it so
really?
Far.
Really? How funny.
So, yeah, they obviously seemed very sort of jealous and threatened, you know, so I don't know what the deal is, but, you know, I mean, at this point, you know, whatever, who cares?
Because how do the boyfriends respond? Like, there's one image I wanted to ask you about specifically, which is the pregnant woman at Evel Knievel Days.
I love this picture. I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah, where there are three people. Is that a woman? I can't.
No, that's a guy.
Okay, so there are two guys. He's older, right? And then there's what looks like the boyfriend because he's holding the hand of the pregnant woman, but they're walking and the two guys are talking and the pregnant woman is the only one really looking at the camera.
Right.
How did you shoot? Did you shoot it and then talk to them?
No, I barely talked to them because here's what was going on in this. This is Evel Knievel Days. So there's a whole bunch of people around. But guess what? That
Evel
is
Knievel
total
Days?
Man's land. It was 2 years ago, right before Evel died. Okay, got there right before Evel died. Perfect timing. Actually got a couple of shots of Evel, you know, whatever. He was like an old, I mean, they're dragging him along. But I was mostly street shooting. But this, Evel Knievel Days and those festivals in Montana are complete man's land because there's a ton of bikers there. They all have these anti-feminist patches on their back. But what's great is they're all in such a great mood that I didn't get any crap from anybody. Okay, so you're walking in whatever land, but everybody's all nice. Now, I wouldn't go there with some big feminist t-shirt on, and I went with a guy friend, you know, just to be on the safe side. But I have gone to Butte, Montana by myself a few times. And I've also gone with gay friends before, so, you know, but you have to kind of be on the down low.
Right.
You know, about your real personality while you're over there. But anyways, I was kind of chasing different people up and down the street that looked interesting to me, and that's kind of what I do. I'll spot somebody in the crowd, and then I'll shoot them. Like, this woman came by, I think, 2 times or 3 times, and so this was maybe the 3rd time I shot her. I only got 1 shot off each. And what I think was, is this, her boyfriend or husband, I believe he was one of the motocross stars, because he was a lot taller and better looking, and they both had nicer clothes on than anybody else there. To me, they were obvious California transplants.
Yeah, she's a blonde and looks very...
Well, and part of why I was chasing her, or the main reason, was because she was so pregnant and she had herself shoved into that really tight shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that that is such, like, when I was younger and women used to wear maternity clothes, and now they try to put the tightest thing on as possible, and that's only happened within the last couple of years, and I just think it's bizarre, especially walking around in public. And I thought it was really interesting, because like I said, there's probably like five guys for every woman at this festival, and a lot of them are big, big bikers that looks like you wouldn't want to tangle with them, but everybody was in a good mood, so it was fine. There's like no problems. Everyone's in a really good mood. And so really, no, I mean, you get a little bit of crap, but not like major crap. And there are a bunch of kids running around, so that does sort of make it safer and stuff. But anyways, I just thought she looked so different because to me, her nose looks like she's had it done.
Mm.
And then she's so pregnant and she's like trying to be this perfect type woman. And then she's got this like rock star type husband, mm-hmm. and he just drags her up and down the street. Like, but that was like the perfect shot. Like, it really shows him dragging her.
It does.
And then this guy is like the classic Butte, and they call him Butte Rats. They call themselves Butte Rats. This is what I learned on that trip to Butte, because usually when you go to Butte, there's no one around, so there's no one around to talk to because it's very, very empty. But like, that's what was fun about going to Evel Knievel Days, is there were so many people, and I met all these people that were from Butte that had come back. You know, they come back to visit their family that weekend or whatever. And so this guy was perfect because he looks like he's had a head injury, possibly from a motorcycle accident. Mm-hmm. He's got over-dyed jeans on and a tie-dyed shirt.
Yep.
And he's very short and kind of, you
scrawny.
Know, he's just, he looks very much how people used to look in Seattle, but now that they've yuppie-ized it, they've gotten rid of all those people and sent them over to Montana or Eastern Washington because they can no longer afford to live here. Because when you're not pretty, you can't compete in the new world. You know, you have to be pretty and stuff. And so what I thought was just interesting is the dynamic of it, because she's got her boyfriend protecting her. He's dragging her up and down the street. On one hand, it's protection. On the other hand, it's control.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like these sort of outsiders, and they're interacting with typical Butte. So, and the other thing I like about this photo is right in the background is the Finland Hotel.
Mm.
And later that night, Spanky Spangler, who's a stunt devil, just like Evel Knievel, lit himself on fire and jumped out that window onto a giant pillow in the street.
Oh.
And it was the wild, wild west. Because, you know, everybody's just standing around the pillow, like, if he misses, he's going to kill a few people. And, you know, and then the other thing is these motocross guys had a giant pile of dirt in the street, and they had about six of them riding towards each other on the giant pile of dirt. Everyone's just sitting right next to it. Like, they could just tip over on you and crash and burn,
right.
and it would kill, like, 40
right.
people or whatever.
Right.
And it's just, I love it, because it sort of reminds me of old Seattle in a certain way. Like, it's rough around the edges, and there was great things about that, and there was bad things about it, and one of the bad things was less safety for women.
Mm.
You know, like, you had to be a lot more cautious, but one of the great things was more freedom for everybody, because you didn't have to be, like, one type or another. Like, you just got to be yourself with your swollen head and your ugly clothes and your fatness, or you're this or you're that, whatever it is, your lazy eye or...
You your know. Lazy eye.
Well, I love people that have flaws. My favorite people in the world have flaws.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I really think that. I think people with flaws are so much more beautiful than people that try to be so perfect, you know.
What about this photograph? Of there's a woman who does not look like she wants you to take her photograph, and that's her.
Oh,
what is it? It's a girl with stuffed rabbit, Evergreen State Fair, Monroe.
Yeah, I've been shooting up the Evergreen State Fair for a couple of years because it's really interesting, the life on the Midway. There's all these teenage kids that hang out there. And they sort of look like it's one of the last places around Seattle that they let the kids go without their parents watching every second.
Mm.
You know, it's like the blue-collar kids kind of get out more. Like, the yuppie moms and dads will never, ever let their kids out of their sight. You know, and I kind of don't blame them because there are a lot of problems. But at the same time, so the kids never learn how to be independent.
Mm.
But I don't know, this girl, like, I felt like I caught her in the act. You know, I mean, to me, she looks like she's caught in the act. I mean, I could make up a story about her, but I really have no idea.
Yeah.
That's part of why I like this photo. The other reason I really like it is she looks like she's 12 or 13 and she's dressed like she's 40.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
she has pantyhose yeah. and high heels yeah. on at yeah. the fair. No
yeah.
other girls had high heels on
yeah.
and pantyhose. And she looked like she was waiting for someone. And so, like, I thought it was for nefarious purposes.
Yeah,
you know?
She does look like she's caught in the act.
Yeah. So, I mean, something. I don't know. I mean, like I said, I'm projecting.
Did you talk to her? Did you say?
Oh, no. Because she ran away right after I took that photo. I only got, like, one photo. Or maybe two. Like, one of her turning. But, no, some people I don't and some people I do. You know, in that case, it was such an awesome photo with the light and everything. I just had to take it. Because it's, like, golden light, which I always look for golden light. Like, a few of these photos have golden light or I like flashlight. But, yeah, she has golden light. The pregnant woman at Evel Knievel Days has golden light. Mm-hmm. You know, I also... You know, I'm really into light now. Mm. You know, that's part of why I like it, you know, and I think that's part of what's helped me do better on the color photos, because a lot of people just, you know, that I started with just did black and white and stuck with black and white, and I like black and white, but Seattle's so gray in the winter, I wanted some color.
Yeah.
So.
You're a colorist.
Switch
to
color, yeah.
When did you switch to color?
Well, interestingly enough, they didn't teach us color at Evergreen. So I went on a long search of how to learn how to print color and how to do it myself. And I ended up taking a class in the early 90s down at the Photo Center Northwest when it was downtown from this Canadian woman about how to print color. And then I volunteered there for about 10 years cleaning everything from cleaning toilets to cleaning the color darkroom just so that I could get time to print, because it took me a really long time to be able to see color. Like, now I can see the difference between really subtle colors. But it's, like, really something you have to train yourself in.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
What size? How do you decide how big to make these? Your photos are usually, they're pretty big. They're not photo size. They're not like, you know, little photo size. They're pretty big.
Well, one of the things, I think the first reason that that started is I made this trip to New York, and I think it was like in the 90s. And I got invited to be in that group show in 99 at the Seattle Art Museum. And what I noticed when I went to New York is the difference between the photo world and the art photo world was the size. And everybody, the old photos were really small because everybody made it at home themselves. And the new photos were everybody paid somebody to print them for them, so they were really big. And so, like, I personally wanted to combine the best of both worlds. I print my own photos. I'm not going to let anybody else print it because it doesn't really turn out. Like, you have all these choices when you're doing it, and if you're not doing it yourself, you're, like, taking all the character out of it as far as I'm concerned. Now, a lot of photographers do not think that's important on any level, or they want to erase their own personal hand on the printing. But to me, that's really important. And, yeah, they're a little bit inconsistent. They're a little bit weird. But, you know, I like them that way. It's kind of the punk rock element of it. Mm-hmm. And I don't want them to get too slick, because now I started scanning my negatives, and I got the used printer from Glazier's at the end of last year, the gigantic one that's like 44 inches wide.
Yeah.
So now I own the means of my production for the first time ever. I'm no longer dependent on the Photo Center and their whims to be able to print, and also the whims of Kodak when they decide to make big paper and when they didn't, because they quit making the really big paper a couple of years ago. Now I hear you can get it again, but like 2 years ago when I tried to get it, I couldn't get any. So it really made me mad, and then I'm like, okay, I got to save up and get that machine, because I think they normally run about $8,000. But then I like saved up and I got it used, so you know, I got everything used. So
that's great.
I know, I'm lucky.
Is that how
I got
your process
it.
Has changed?
Yeah,
I know it has. Okay,
yeah, I got the negative scanner, so I'm scanning for my negatives. So it's still the same negatives in film. I still love film because I do shoot digital, but you really cannot get the same effects. It just looks different, fundamentally different. And, you know, I think it's the same thing musicians say about a digital recording versus an LP. You know, I still love my LPs. I grew up with them. I hear something in them that I just don't hear in the CDs. I mean, I do have CDs, but it's much more pleasurable to me to listen to the LP. It has more, I don't know what it is, like more zhuzh. And it sort of seems like that's how the negatives are. Because to me, my digital negatives look flatter and there's not as much information. You know, plus when you're shooting out somewhere, digital is kind of bad because you can get water in it. You can't go if it's raining. You know, you can't do anything. You can't jump in the fountain at Gay Pride. Like, one day I was at the camera repair store the day after Gay Pride, and there was at least three people in there that had jumped in the fountain with their digital cameras and wrecked them. And I was like, oh, thank God I've got film, because I jumped in the fountain too, but I didn't wreck my camera. I took the flash off and put it away first.
That's awesome.
So it's like,
intrepid.
Okay.
You can do more. What's it like? So when you scan the negatives, then you just do the printing. How do you do that? How are you doing, like,
Photoshop.
Color work? And you're using
it's all in Photoshop, which is interesting because Photoshop, like, I finally learned it this year.
Yeah, how do you feel about Photoshop? Do you like
it? Well, it almost makes it more like a painting, you know, because I used to paint before I did photography. I grew up painting.
Do you change them much?
I try not to because I think I can overdo it. And maybe on a couple of these I did overdo it just because it is the first time through. But I do change it. I have a lot more control over burning and dodging than I did in the darkroom. Because in the darkroom, when you're printing these giant prints, it's like, it's physically really difficult because you've got to lift the paper up and you've got to, there's no easel that's big enough to put the paper on. So you've got to like arrange it. Like usually I had a cardboard tape to the thing and then you have to like line it up with the edges. And this is, mind you, is in the complete darkness because color is all done in the complete darkness. And then you have to burn and dodge all the different spots in the picture and stuff. So it's like, you know, usually there's maybe 5 or 6 burns and dodges, but you're doing it all in the dark. So sometimes you don't always get the spot right. Mm-hmm. And you don't always get the right, like, you can count it, but it's hard to get, like, 3 prints that are exactly the same, even if you're counting, like, 10 seconds burn here. You know, because you do all these different, it's sort of mathematical when you're doing it in the darkroom. So on the computer, what's great is you can do it really fast, you can do it intuitively, and you can do each spot. So instead of doing 10 spots, you can do 20 spots that you're burning and dodging. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, maybe it's becoming a little bit more perfectionist, but I don't want to lose that rough edge to it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want it to be super slick. Because I noticed on the digital printer, it's like the grain structure, it looks totally different from the other printing. I mean, the pictures, you cannot get them to match, I don't think. Mm-hmm. You know, which is fine. It's time to move on. It's unfortunate. I mean, I love those old prints. Love, love, love them. But it's like time to move on now. Plus, the other thing I do like about digital is my eyesight went out this year. Like, I finally got glasses. So. And, you know, it's really hard to focus color grain structure. It's really, really dim compared to black and white. So I think it would be really hard to make those big ones because when you blow them up that big, the grain structure. So I think part of why I was able to do it for so long was because I had really, really, really good vision. And my distance vision is still pretty good. It must be 20/30 now, but my up-close vision is bad now.
Really?
So, yeah.
Yeah, and how are you liking the digital prints? Like, what do you think of this show print-wise?
They're so awesome because the paper is so thick. And so we were able to just put them straight up on the wall without having to worry about damaging the prints. And I love the way they look that way. And I made a really big border so that when they're framed, they can get cut off, you know, so we can wreck the border. And, you know, and I think that gives it sort of an immediacy that the other prints behind glass don't. And then because of the economy, too, is why I didn't frame them all. If I would have had, you know, $5,000, I would have framed them all. But
sure.
I don't. So, and, you know, I probably won't. You know, there's just not that much money this year, so.
Let's talk about the video.
Oh, yeah, I do want to talk about the video.
So it's called Girl Revolution, and you shot it at Youngstown.
Yeah, and I made it with my friend Alicia Woods. She's my partner in that, and she's a filmmaker that went to the Native Voices. She just graduated from the Native Voices graduate master's degree program from the University of Washington. Mm-hmm. And so she makes films, but she doesn't make art films. She makes documentaries. And I said, well, do you want to collaborate on an art film? Because ever since I've seen the Trues videos, which I've never really seen art videos before that I liked, you know, because I always read about them in Art in America, but it's so different to actually see one versus, you know, get one. And I'm not very good at going out and running videos or finding them online. We were looking online and we couldn't even find any, so I don't know. I'm not quite sure how to do it, but it's like, we decided to make this video. It's really awesome. We did use Youngstown, because that's both where we live. You know, we live at the artist colony or whatever out there. And I would say, use your resources, you know. And then the whole idea was like inspired by the idea of Paris Hilton transforming into Patty Hearst, Tanya of the SLA. You know, and I just thought that was a great image because what if somebody like Paris Hilton, who is so vacant and, you know, pretty vacant, like the Sex Pistols or whatever. I mean, I think that about a lot of people. And sort of is the height of what's kind of bad for women in a certain way because she's so, like, rail thin. Nobody else could be that thin. And then she has a new outfit every single day. And then she's just so narcissistic, like she has some new show on TV. And the whole thing is sort of about making fun of these people that want to be her best friend and stuff. And I was like, well, what if she, like, read Rules for Radicals and, like, became, like, a feminist and, like, was like Patty Hearst, you know, Tanya of the SLA. And I know maybe, because I'm a little bit older, like, both me and my other friends that are my age, like, we were young when that happened, you know, because that happened in the 60s, but we were all, like, secretly excited about it. Like, secret young revolutionaries. We were all like, ooh, Tanya of the SLA, like, well, let's run away to California and be revolutionaries or whatever. I mean, you know, like a childhood fantasy or whatever.
And you've got kids to do it.
You got kids?
Oh, yeah. Video.
It's like 12-year-olds or 10-year-olds.
Yeah, they're between, I think, 9 and 13.
They're amazing.
Well, guess what? They're all my friends' daughters because a whole bunch of people I know have daughters now. Like, Alicia's daughter is in it. And then my other friend, Susan Hashem, came up from Portland and did the hair and makeup and styling for us. And her daughter and son are in it. Mm. And, yeah, we didn't quite sure if Henry was going to be in it. And then he was just like, I'm the mascot. I want to be in it. So I'm like, okay. And then the awesome part is that we filmed, like, one day. It was, like, a really long shoot. And we filmed, like, all the stuff in the school. And we sort of turned them, you know, from whatever, pretty girls to, like, hardcore radicals.
Radical,
but kind of in a fun way, you know. It's like we're kind of playing off the imagery of the student radicals of the 60s and the Black Panthers, because I love the Black Panthers. Like, we have a Angela Davis in the background and stuff. And the soundtrack actually has featuring words by Black Panther Elaine Brown in it that are offline, you know, that are our guy, Tran's sister, who's another guy in our building, did the soundtrack first, which I think is really great. And I love that movie because we were able to combine some setup stuff with some regular stuff. And what happened was, while we were working on the movie, because we were working on it for a couple months, so we filmed one day, and, you know, it's absolutely exhausting, and then you get a lot less footage than you think. It's the first movie I've made, so I had no idea.
Yeah.
And so then a few weeks later, we had Delridge Days out there. So that's where the rappers come from, and the kids hula hooping and the dancing. And then I was like, oh, man, this is going to look like it's the Girl Revolution if we hang the banner out the window again, right? We made that big banner hanging out the window, which was really fun, I thought. And I'm just going to hang the banner up periodically just for the hell of it because I like it so much.
Nice.
And nobody said anything, so we did okay on that. No one complained. So.
What did the girls say? What did they know about what they were doing?
Oh, the girls loved it.
What did they know about what they were doing?
That's a good question. I think some of them know more because really all their moms are feminists. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they wouldn't really be in it. You know what I mean? Like, because I didn't want to pick any girls whose moms would freak out.
Yeah.
There was only two girls that I didn't know their moms. So
okay.
They were friends of.
I had this recent experience where I was talking with a lot of writers from around the world and about feminism.
Oh, cool.
And so I wanted to ask you, you think of yourself as a feminist?
Absolutely.
Yeah, me too.
I believe in equal pay for equal work. That's the definition of feminism.
Okay.
Equal pay for equal work and not discriminating against somebody. Not trying to do this one up, I'm pissing on your leg because you're a girl and you threaten me kind of crap. Like, I'm sick of that. I'm sick of it and I'm announcing it to the world because I'm finally old enough now to stand up for myself. Because for so long, there's one of my experiences in Seattle is so many male photographers have come up and told me over the years that I wasn't good enough, that I shouldn't be doing it, that it was embarrassing to have my stuff out in public. Like, what the hell am I doing?
Wow.
You know, you're like, you're a big piece of crap, basically. Go home and hide. Why don't you go have babies?
Wow.
You know, and, like, I've shared dark rooms with these guys. I've known them, like, for 25 years now. And surprisingly enough, the same thing happened now. So it's like, you know, this is when guys get threatened, they come up and piss on your leg. And so now, instead of just standing there and take it, I'm like, no, you're wrong. You know, like, maybe that's not the right way of dealing with it. Maybe next year I'll have a better way of dealing with it. But I'm like, shut up.
Wow.
You know, because it's like what I notice, and this is my personality, because I grew up in Nebraska and we want to be nice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like some guy comes up.
A lot of girls want to be nice. We all want to be nice.
Yeah, that's why the good girl picture is in here.
Yeah, yeah.
Because she's a good girl, but she looks really bad, you know, which is what I like.
Yeah.
She's awesome.
Woman
yeah.
With pink halter top. Yeah.
Yeah. And she has, like, good girl written on her arm and a tattoo. And, you know, I always collect people with word tattoos. That's one of the things I always look for is people that have words. What do you choose to label yourself permanently with?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of why I love that photo is because not only is she playing, like, this image of a good girl, which we all do, especially when some guy comes up and starts harassing us, we think if we're nice enough and sweet enough, we can turn it around, and sometimes we can.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of insipid. You know, it makes us feel bad later. I mean, I go away and I feel really depressed and, like, why the hell did I do that? But at the time, it's almost like you're defending yourself from getting beat, you know, but just with somebody's words. Instead of, like, their fists, you know. But I mean, that's the next thing is, like, somebody could haul off and pop you, you know, if you don't go, if you're not nice to them, they could haul off and pop you. And, you know, in my experience, they have before. So
really,
oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely over the years. Not lately. I don't let anyone get near me like that. But, you know, when I was younger, sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, between my dad and, like, some of my ex-boyfriends and just people in public because, you know, like, one time I was out shooting Howard Dean, actually, for The Stranger, when I used to work for The Stranger when he was getting all big. And me and Jillian Garr, you know, who's another female photographer, we got there early, and so we were standing. We got right up by the stage. And, you know, that's, I know the secret to getting good photographs is to plan ahead and get there early because a lot of the other people blow in at the last minute. And so you get the best spot if you get there early, and you got to make sure you don't have to go to the bathroom so you don't have to leave because you lose your spot, right? So you've got to be just, like, ready to stay there for, like, an hour and be bored. So luckily Jillian was next to me, so we were chitty-chatting. And which is nice when somebody you know is there. So then at the last minute, all these guys blow in from AP or whatever. They were obviously nobody I'd ever seen before. Like, they were probably photographers for 5 minutes and then went on to some other gig because they were very aggressive. This guy must have been like 6'4", 6'5". He was a really big guy. And he came up and stood physically on top of us because he wanted our spot.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's like, dude, take one step back. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he's towering over us anyway, so it's not like we were blocking his view.
Right.
He wanted to tell everyone that he was important. Mm-hmm. You know? And the same thing, like, that has happened so many different times. Like, oh, when I get sent to photograph John Kerry for The Stranger again.
Mm-hmm.
People don't like The Stranger in the writer's eye, so the photographer takes the brunt of whatever Dan says, basically, and then Dan never hears about it because Dan doesn't want to hear about it, so it's like, but man, the backstage guy, and I never got his name because he's going to grow up to be Mr. Carl Rove Jr. I got his photo, though, just in case so I can blackmail him in 20 years, because he was a little sociopath, and he picked out me and Jillian again, you know, because she's at a lot of different things, too, that I go to. And herded us off and wouldn't let us go do our photos and then let all these guys do it. And he was totally doing it on purpose. And he was laughing at us and stuff. And, you know, we're like, oh, well, we want to talk to your boss. Oh, what's your name? You know, and it, like, he's just not cooperating. And, you know, you either get the photo or you don't. So I screwed him. And after, I mean, I, like, went ahead because, like, he wouldn't let me get access to the stage. Otherwise, I would have gotten dragged out and arrested. And they'd only let us get access from this really bad angle on the side, which made both of Carrie and Mrs. Carrie look horrible. Like, mm-hmm. You cannot get a good photo from that angle at all. And so then he jumped into the crowd to start shaking hands afterward. Well, I plunged in after him, and I got all the way up close and got a great photo one-on-one, like me standing right at his chest.
Mm.
Because the thing about going to so many punk rock shows for so long is I know how to work a crowd, and I'm not afraid to jump into a crowd and push my way through. And see, they don't expect women to do that. We're supposed to be dainty. You know, that's how I got shots of Mary Kay Letourneau, too. I beat every guy that was down there. Because when Mary Kay Letourneau, I was shooting for The Weekly then, and when she got arrested the second time when it was big international news, all these guys flew in. It was the first paparazzi chase I've ever seen in Seattle. Like, seriously, there was mass people here. And it was mass crowded. And so I got there early again, and I positioned myself right by the door where she was going to come out because the cops told us. And then it was funny because I was standing there for, like, an hour, and then, like, this guy comes up to me, and he's all like, move. I want to stand here. And I'm like, no, I got her first. Oh, well, you're not very important. You're blah, 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 blah. And like, oh, like, I'm from NBC, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I don't care where you're from. Because they try to, like, impress you with their credentials that you should bow down to them and whatever. Like, that has happened to me so many times. Like, well, I'm from this or I'm from that and you're doing it wrong. Right. You know, I mean, I can list like 100 times where I've gone out on shoots and some guy has come up to me and said, you're doing it wrong. And I'm like, well, guess where my photo's going to be in Newsweek? Where's your photo? Some stupid online journal. You know, that's when I went to shoot Bill Gates and I was like laying on my stomach, like in front of him. They're like, you're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong. And I'm like, well, my photo ran really big in Newsweek. Where'd yours run? So. And it's just like, you know, they always think you have to do it in a certain way.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
They try to tell you because I guess they're really threatened by anybody that doesn't do it just like they thought.
And you're
they
doing,
had to.
You're not doing much photojournalism anymore, are you?
There's no money.
Yeah.
I mean, The Stranger gets free photos off of Flickr now, or they have Kelly.
Yeah.
I mean, if I could, I would, but
yeah.
There's none.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, journalism has died this year. You guys
yeah.
are lucky you're still in business.
No kidding.
Because, I mean, every photographer I know has had to go out and get a job, which I'm sort of in the process of still working with my mom and my stepdad. My mom has Alzheimer's and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think next year I'll probably get a full-time job.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but luckily this year I had a little bit of time, which is why I was able to do the show and the movie. And then my friend Alicia and I are planning on making, like, a series of films.
Oh, great. Okay.
So this is hopefully just the beginning. And my theory is that I want to make, like, 5 or 6 short films. Okay. And I want them all to be fun. Mm-hmm. You know, I want them to be an art movie, but I don't like those ones where there's, like, a picture of a tree and it lasts for, like, 10 minutes and you have to, like, think about it or whatever. Like, those just are not my taste. Like, I want to interact with people that aren't into, like, esoteric crap, you know? I mean, my stuff doesn't necessarily appeal to those people that like the Emperor's New Clothes and art. I like the real. But it's funny because, like, over the years, no matter what people have said, my stuff has gotten more and more popular. Like, I have a big popular following now. I was surprised at how many people recognize my work and stuff. And I think it's kind of cool. Of course, that doesn't translate to any money,
right?
Which is really funny because that's kind of the same thing that happened to all the women I knew in music. Like, all the Riot Girls, they were all really famous, and none of them made a penny.
Yeah.
They're all dirt poor. And that's what I think, maybe that's part of the sort of sexism that's still prevalent in our culture, is the women just don't make any money. It's like they're just as famous and just as hardworking, or maybe even twice as hardworking as the guys. Because sometimes you always have to work twice as hard to get ahead, you know?
Right.
And so I think things are going to change. But I think right now there's kind of a backlash because, like, Obama getting in. And I've heard this from, like, a few of my African-American friends, too, that there's a big racist backlash going on. There's a lot more racism. And I've noticed, like, a lot more threatening gender crap going on lately. And on one hand, it's great to do the show now because I finally feel like I can tell the truth. Because under Bush, I didn't feel like I could tell the truth. Like, I felt like I was hiding, like, the whole time. Because if you said too much, who knows? Maybe they'd throw you in the gulag. I mean, you know, I don't know. It was true. You know, all the paranoid fantasies became true under Bush. And, you know, I'm too old for that crap. I might have done it when I was 20, but I don't have a criminal record. And I'm able to do things and get clearances to teach children and stuff because I don't. And I don't want to have one. So, you know, I don't want to get arrested for some stupid protest thing just so, you know, it would wreck my teaching career. So,
well,
it's like, whatever.
I'm glad you can tell the truth now. This is the show. You should go see it, everybody. It's at Greg Kucera Gallery. Thank you so much, Alice. It's been great.
Oh, thank you. This was really fun. I enjoyed myself.
Cool. Thanks for listening. This is The Stranger and Invisible. Thanks.